Well, I'm going to talk about the Inferno in 1 hour, which is the equivalent of saying, let's take 20 minutes and climb Everest. So I'll just begin by saying this is an impossibility. And I'm going to make it worse by giving you just a little schema of how to approach a work of literature. This is our first. So when you pick up one of these books, what do you do? How do you begin? Well, let's take some obvious things. Let's assume you go to the library and you pull a book off the shelf and you've heard of the author. You know this is one of those books you should read. You haven't read before. I think that the first thing that is necessary is to recognize that all literature comes out of a specific time and place and was written by real human beings. It is very easy for these names to become hallowed as the years go by, and we say Dante or Shakespeare, and of course those of us who teach literature do it very reverentially, and we should. These were great men. But in their own age, there is a sense that they were human beings who were given special gifts, who were struggling as writers, who sat down as any of us sit down with a blank piece of paper. Any writer is basically facing a blank piece of paper and has to put something down. Dante sat down, and after many blank pieces of paper, there was the Divine Comedy. Shakespeare sat down, blank pieces of paper, there was Hamlet. And it's remarkable what they put on the paper, but nevertheless, the process is the same. They were writers. They had paper, they took a pen, they wrote, and material got down there. And it's important to remember that they were real men living in a real time, a specific context. So, the first thing you need to do is give yourself some time to understand who the writer is before you launch into the work. I think it is good to get a little background. I'm not saying go get a biography and read the whole biography, but it's easy enough to get a kind of quick compendium, and there are certain things you need to know. Let me give you just some quick examples. I'm not going to do a complete life of Dante for you now, but I'm going to give you some high points that I think are very important to understand if you're going to get any grasp at all of the Divine Comedy. First, Dante, born 1265. We put him in a particular context. He was born in 1265. He died in 1321. Those are the years that define the life of the man. Why is that significant? Because it tells us he was a medieval writer. He was a man of the Middle Ages. That in and of itself will give us certain things we need to know that can be helpful when we look at the work. And in that sense, being a medieval writer, what do we know? He was medieval, he was Italian, he was Catholic. And his Catholicism is essential to understanding him. In the same way, and I'm not making the point that all great writers therefore must be Catholic, what do we know? Let's take another great writer, Nathaniel Hawthorne, great American writer, 19th century, comes out of a Puritan tradition. Important to know. That influenced him mightily. He was a great writer. And that's a way in which we define. We have to define the author in a context. Dante was medieval. He was Catholic. Although Lieutenant Childs can tell you he was at a conference last fall of supposedly conservative literary critics in which a scholar gave a talk explaining how Dante was really a hidden Muslim. All of his sympathies were really with the Muslim faith. This is what the conservative literary critics are doing now. Even they're all mad. Be careful what you read. Best recommendation, if you're reading a book for background, biography, context, make sure it's printed before about 1960. You'll at least still get sane information. The closer it's printed to the modern time, you don't know what Dante a Muslim. You know, give me a break. In any case, Italian, Catholic, medieval, which means he comes out of a very specific and well-constituted worldview. Let me put it this way, and I think this is important to understanding the entire Divine Comedy. Modern man, and I'm not speaking about specific individuals now, I'm speaking about a contemporary modern man, thoughtful, who has been raised in the modern schools, goes out in the night and looks at the night sky, and his world is defined by the world he grew up in. He will see the same stars in the sky that were seen by medieval man, but curiously, he is not seeing the same thing. Modern man looks out and first of all sees a scientific universe. He will see stars that we have named, we have defined, we've sent spaceships out there. We know how many light years away they are. We have a sense that we have knowledge of the universe. We know about the Milky Way, we know about galaxies, and modern man looks at the sky and has some sense of, I know that, I understand that, science has told me things about that. And then, because modern man is schizoid, modern man will say, and I'm a tiny little puny creature here, and it's all big and dark and empty, and there's really nothing out there other than matter. Burning gases and planets and rock whirling around, and it's all set in motion by accident, and I am very small and insignificant. What does it all mean? Nothing. He despairs. He goes and has a drink and watches Mr. Ed reruns and eats Cheetos. And look at the same night sky. And the first thing that medieval man would see would be order. Complete order. But not scientific order, God's order. There were the spheres. The spheres were numbered. There were nine of them. They moved and made music as they moved. It was all created by a creator. It was created with a specific order. And it was full. It was rich. It was not empty. And medieval man knew his place. He was not an insignificant nothing. Medieval man was a son of God created for a specific purpose and had an integral part in that created order. And he knew what it was. And as a result, he then went to Mass and then would go home and raise his family and go out. And his concern, his fear was, I'm hoeing, but I don't know if there'll be any potatoes this year to feed the family. Or the plague may come along and kill us all. He had real fears, but they were not those fears of modern man. It's empty. What does it mean? I'm nothing. It wasn't modern angst. It was, will there be food on the table? Will the plague come through again this year? Will my family survive? They were very, very different fears. Now, I emphasize that order because you have to have some sense of that medieval order, which Dante, being a medieval man, would reflect, so that he descends into the inferno. He comes to structure his Divine Comedy. He is going to write about hell. And what does he do as he imagines, as a creative artist? He was creating this. Again, we have an imaginative creation here. And it's very interesting because there was the concept of hell. The word was tossed around. Dante, to a large degree, has defined it for all of us afterwards. We take many of our visions of what it's like from him. But what we don't, we still have the flames, the torture, the suffering, the noise, the stench. All that's from Dante. What we don't have that Dante, being medieval, gives it is order. There are circles. Just as there are spheres in the heavens, God himself created hell, and therefore hell is an ordered place. Hell is filled with order. And as Dante and Virgil descend through the inferno, they are descending through an ordered realm that is logical and reasonable. And that is part of the medieval mind. Dante being medieval, there it is. Secondly, Italian, Catholic, which means his principal concern was the soul's movement to God. In one sense, being a medieval Catholic, Dante knew why he was here and where he was going. That was answered for him. And that is very much the basis of the work. In order to understand why the Divine Comedy exists, you have to know Dante was a Catholic. Dante, being a Catholic, knows that the soul must move to God, and indeed, the entire work, and 3 weeks from now we'll end this up, we end at the top of the Paradiso, we move to that outer circle and we have a glimpse of the Godhead. An astonishing moment. But that's the end of the work. Logically, because that was the end of the purpose of the entire existence of the soul. And so Dante gives us that. We can't understand that without really having some sense, without having some sense of Dante as Catholic. In fact, he said quite openly at one point, this is also very medieval, very medieval. There had to be a purpose. You wouldn't just write for the sake of writing. You would write to say something because there was something you needed to tell. And he says, this is actually in a letter that he wrote to a patron of his, a man by the name of Cangrande della Scala, a nobleman in northern Italy who took Dante in when he was in exile. I'll talk about that in just a moment. But he says in the letter, the subject of the whole work then, taken merely in the literal sense, is the state of the soul after death, straightforwardly affirmed. What he was putting down, here's what happens to the soul after death. Here are the options, here are the possibilities. But if indeed the work is taken allegorically, that's in a literal sense. You die, where do you go? I'll show you. That's just very literal. But he says it also can be taken as an allegory. That means one thing standing for something else. But if indeed the work is taken allegorically, its subject is man, as by good or ill deserts, in the exercise of his free choice, he becomes liable to rewarding or punishing justice. The work is about the justice of God. That's medieval. That's Catholic. He's presenting that vision. But notice, it is not just God there who seeks to destroy, and we'll come upon that vision very soon. The vision of a dark and malevolent God will haunt one of the works we're looking at. No. This is God rewarding or punishing because of man, in the exercise of his own free choice, earning good or ill. And we can say all the way through the Inferno. It's a simple fact about the Inferno. No one is sent to hell. All of the souls who are there have chosen hell. That's made very clear as we go along. In any case, what we get again then is Dante the medieval Catholic. Dante the medieval Catholic. What else do we need to know? Some other things we need to know. Historically, what were the historical circumstances? Well, Dante was born into a troubled historical period. Very difficult time in Italy. There were very strong city-states, and they were at war. It was a period of warfare. It was a period of turmoil. Within the individual city-states, there was turmoil. There was disruption. There were large political problems and large political questions, even within the cities. Dante was born in Florence. Florence was the city he loved. He is in probably the most famous son of Florence, and yet, born in 1265, in the year 1301, he's thrown out of Florence and is never allowed to go back. Florence shuts its doors. Indeed, there's a painting in the great Duomo in Florence of Dante, holding the Divine Comedy, a vision of the city of Florence behind him, and the painter knew the doors of Florence are closed. Dante's not getting back in. He was sent on an embassy to the Pope. He went while he was gone. There was a change of government in the city, and they decreed, you're not coming back. You're out of here. And he spent the last 21 years of his life in exile. He was an exile. He was a wanderer. He was a pilgrim soul who could not find rest in his native city. And that influences this work. As he writes the Divine Comedy, there's a reason why in his mind what he's writing about is the pilgrim soul. It may be the vision of Dante the pilgrim, who's a character in the work, I'll speak of that in a moment, who's wandering through the Inferno, the Purgatorio, the Paradiso, but Dante was a wanderer. He knew what it meant to be a wanderer. He was shut out from his own city. Essential information. You can't read the Divine Comedy if you don't know this. Background. We need background. 1274. Dante is 9 years old. He's invited to a May Day party at the home of an Italian nobleman named Folco Porfinari. He goes to the party and there sees the daughter of this man, who is an 8-year-old little girl named Beatrice. The first glimpse of Beatrice, as she's known in English. And he instantly falls in love. This is his own description of it. We have to trust him at his word. He got that glimpse. He never really got to know her. She married someone else. They did not have a great deal of contact, but he held the image of that beauty. And she became for him the symbol of all that is good, pure, and virtuous in this world. It's fascinating in one sense. He married another woman. He married another woman named Gemma Donate. You never hear of her. She's not mentioned in the work. Throughout the work, the vision of the woman he adores is this lady Beatrice. You can imagine how happy his wife would be knowing this was going on. But curiously, she spent much of her time in Florence when her husband was in exile. Eventually, the family went and lived with him, but they were separated for long periods of time. But we have something else going on here. My point being, you need to have some sense of historical period, some sense of biography. Here comes something else. You need to have some sense of literary tradition. Dante was not inventing something out of whole, cutting something out of whole cloth. Not inventing. There have been very few original minds ever. What Dante was doing was taking something and adapting it. What do we have? Dante was writing after the time of the chivalric romances, in which the knight chose a lady. And the knight loved that lady and saw in that lady embodied all that was good and pure and noble. He may indeed marry someone else, but that's domestic life. That's the at-home life. That's the life of diapers and raising potatoes and putting money. And that is essential. But for the time we're talking about in the literary tradition, it is the difference of something you may know. It's the Arthurian romances. And Lancelot chooses as his lady Guinevere. She may have been married to someone else. Beatrice was married to someone else. But she remained the vision for him, the ideal vision. Dante's writing out of that tradition. It's important to know it. But of course, when we hit Dante, he's writing out of a number of traditions. He's also writing out of the epic tradition. Dante knew his Homer and respected Homer and Virgil and the great epics they had written. He had studied them thoroughly. He knew the Iliad. He knew the Aeneid. And when he comes to write the Divine Comedy, he's writing, in a curious way, an epic. Well, how do we know that? He follows the rules of the epic. An epic has to begin in the middle of the story. Well, let's look at the very first line of the first canto of the Inferno. Look at the very first line of the poem. Where does he begin? Midway along the journey of our life. It's a signal. You want to know what one way, you want to know what I'm writing? I'll tell you what I'm writing. If the epic has to begin, it's in Latin called in medias res, in the middle of the story. I'm going to begin in the middle of the story, and I'll announce it. Midway along the journey of our life. I found myself, he says. I woke to find myself in a dark wood. Halfway through my life, halfway through my story, here's where I was. This is an epic. Slap. It also means the epic has to have an epic hero. Who's the epic hero? Dante himself, who's going on a long journey of discovery, who is, if you will, a kind of knight who will be out there, who's a warrior, who will be out there fighting not different kinds of monsters, but the Inferno's populated with monsters. It's one reason for its popularity. All of the great monsters are in the Inferno. We encounter them one after another. What else must an epic have? At some point in an epic, you have to have a descent into hell. Well, okay, yeah, well, part one. Got it. Okay? You need extended epic similes. They're everywhere. They're everywhere. We'll start a simile and it'll go on for line after line. A comparison. An extended comparison goes on for line after line after line after line. He has dozens of them in here. It's an epic. It's like a chivalric romance. It's like an epic. Okay? He's writing out of some of the popular forms of his own day. He's also proving himself. Look what I can do. I can write the way these great writers in the past wrote, and I can be as good as they are. Early on in the Inferno, it's a great moment. Before we really begin the descent, we're in the first circle. And the first circle is reserved for those classical souls who were good men, but because they lived before Christ, cannot be allowed to make the journey. They may not enter heaven. But they live in a very pleasant place. The first circle of hell is really a pleasant place to be. And he goes and visits there with Virgil, and he meets Homer and Ovid and Lucan, some of his favorite classical poets, and they say to him, "Look, it's Dante. Hi, Dante. Glad to meet you." And treat him as an equal. It's probably the most glorious example of arrogance in all of literature. The man writes this work, and as he's writing it, is basically saying, "They're my buddies." And not only that, they recognize how good I am. It's, you know, they can tell it right away. What we have. Now, can we call it pride? Well, difficult question. Is it proud to be aware of your own greatness? He was a great poet, one of the greatest ever. He knew it. He knew he was as good as Homer, as good as Virgil. And indeed, his name is added to the list. Homer, Virgil, Dante. You know, you run through the list. His name is in there. He said, "Yeah, I know that." Was he proud? No, because he's going to descend through those circles, and he's going to have that pride just wrung out of him. But early on, whoo, there it is. What we have at the beginning, and it's very clear, it happens all the way along, and we begin to see as we go along, we also have a personal confession. In a curious way, we have a work in the line of the Confessions of St. Augustine. We have an individual soul who is saying, "Let me tell you about the mistakes I made. Let me tell you who I was. Let me tell you how foolish and wrong-headed I was." And where do we begin? It makes perfect sense. We descend into hell. That hell of vice and error and sin. And as I mentioned earlier, what we have, and it's the glory of literature, Dante does not have to sin directly. He can be there and react to it and be tempted by it and come to understand it and move on. But he can't escape it completely. And as he puts it down, we come to understand it. Again, we need to understand the context. We need to understand the man. We need to understand the man. And finally, we need to understand the title. It sounds very, very foolish, but I'm not joking. Even the simplest titles of literary works are clues, some of the best clues we have to what's going on in them. The Divine Comedy tells us a ton about the work. The great epics tended to be serious. Many of the other earlier great poets, Greeks and Romans, wrote tragedies. This man is writing a comedy, and he's telling us by that he means, not there are going to be a lot of jokes in here, and it's, you know, no one has ever turned to the Divine Comedy for real belly laughs. It's not that kind of work, although there's much in there that is humorous, and there are moments of low comedy, as low as anything you'll find in modern farce, only funnier. But overall, comedy means structure. And the structure being referred to is this may be a serious work, but it will not end with destruction. It will not end with that sense of pity and fear and loss. It will end with reconciliation, a vision of glory. I don't want to use the word happy ending because we've denigrated it. It will end with an explosion of joy. So we know as we read through it where we're going. He tells us, the title tells us, but it's a divine comedy, okay? It's a spiritual journey. It's a spiritual journey. It's not a journey in this world. Even though we will recognize things from this world as we go through it. It's a divine comedy. One other thing, comedy. comedy, it's written in what for Dante would have been the vulgar tongue. The great classical writers wrote in great classical languages. Dante wrote a good deal. He wrote many of his serious prose works in Latin. He wrote poems in Latin. But he came to write this work and he says, okay, I'm writing something, it's a comedy, it's popular. He wrote in Italian, and he established Italian as a literary language in this poem. He was writing in a language that people could understand. It was common, which means he was not aiming for high literary eloquence, but he was proving what you could do with the language of your day. In that sense, it's a very experimental work, tied to tradition, coming out of various literary traditions, aware of those traditions, but doing something brand spanking new at the same time. He was climbing up on the shoulders of those giants who had gone before and waving, look at me, look at me, look what I can do. He does that in here, partially by the language that he chooses. All of these things, just ways of getting in. And you need to spend some time. You need to spend some time with any work before you really dive into it. Get some sense of background. Now, I want to give you just some guidelines for going through this. It's, as I said, I've left myself half an hour now to cover the Divine Comedy, the Inferno. It's not possible. But let me give you some clues for reading it, some guidelines for reading it, which I hope will be helpful. And we can look at some specifics this afternoon. We're going to gather at 3 this afternoon, okay? We'll get together at 3 this afternoon. Informal discussion. So come with questions, whatever. This afternoon's purely informal. Just sit around and chat about all this. And we can get into some of the specific scenes this afternoon. What do you need to know as you read through this poem? Well, let's go back to the letter to Can Grande della Scala. This is difficult to know, but you have to keep it in mind right from the beginning, and that is, it is a complex work. Don't be intimidated by it. The first time through any work, it's like meeting someone who's going to be a good friend. First time you meet him, you're just beginning to get the basics. What's this person like? Don't try to do it all on a first reading. You can't do it. What do you do on a first reading? Just get the basics. What's going on here? Where am I going? What's happening? What's basically, go back to my earlier lecture, what's the story here? Just what's happening, incident by incident. How are we moving from point to point? Where do we start? Where do we end? What happens along the way? Who do we meet? Nevertheless, as you come back to the work, a great work will keep opening itself up. It will offer you more and more, the way a very good friend does. Why do we want to get together with old friends? Why are old friends the best friends? It's not that we've worn them out. It's not that, well, I've spent a lot of time with this person before. I don't want to see you again. Don't come and visit. I've spent much time with you, and I think I've pretty much emptied you, okay? The point being, those people don't become good friends. The good friends are the ones you enjoy spending time with, and the more time you spend with them, the more facets you discover, the more interesting it becomes, and you want to spend more and more time. It is the movement from simple understanding to complex understanding to real appreciation and deep love. That's what friendship is about. It's what a good marriage should be, okay? And it's the same thing with a great work of literature. Here is Dante again in the letter to Can Grande della Scala explaining how to look at the work. And he says the meaning of this work is not simple. He announces at the beginning, I wrote something complex here. This is tough. For we obtain one meaning from the letter of it, and another from that which the letter signifies. Look, there's one meaning just in terms of what I put down, but what I put down is also standing for something else. And the first is called literal, but the other is allegorical or mystical. Two levels to look on it. I mentioned some of this earlier. And to make this matter of treatment clearer, it may be studied in the verse. Now he takes a Bible verse to explain what he's doing. When Israel came out of Egypt and the house of Jacob from among a strange people, Judah was his sanctuary and Israel his dominion. For if we regard the letter alone, what is set before us is the exodus of the children of Israel from Egypt in the days of Moses. If you just look at what it says, it's talking about a historical action. This is what happened. That's the letter of the text. If the allegory, if we look at the allegory of it, what's it really saying? If the allegory, our redemption wrought by Christ, the freeing of the Jewish people from the exile in Egypt, is on an allegorical level telling us about our redemption wrought by Christ. If the moral sense, if we read the same passage looking at it in terms of morality, if the moral sense, we are shown the conversion of the soul from the grief and wretchedness of sin to the state of grace. Same passage, entirely different way of looking at it. If the anagogical, this means existing on multiple levels simultaneously, we are shown the departure of the holy soul from the thraldom of this corruption to the liberty of eternal glory. And although these mystical meanings are called by various names, they may all be called in general allegorical, since they differ from the literal and historical. It takes one verse from the Bible, gives it to us on four levels, and says, I've written a work that's that complex. I'm doing the same thing. Well, okay. But that awareness is to a degree a challenge. But the first thing you do when you read it, you must read it for the literal sense. What does it mean? Whenever I teach poetry, the first battle is always getting the students to simply look at the words on the page and assign the literal meaning. What does this mean? They immediately want to leap to wild, and you know, they want to go all the way to the end. My favorite example, I had a colleague who was teaching Keats's sonnet on first looking into Chapman's Homer. A sonnet written by Keats when he got a copy of Homer, the Odyssey, translated by Chapman. A man named Chapman. And he read it, and it was a wonderful experience. And he talks about how moving it was to him, how much he learned. The student wrote a paper about Keats going out to the ballpark. It's a nice day. They're playing the game in front of him. He's sitting in the stands. And my colleague said, what is this paper? What is this student talking about? And we sat puzzling over it. And I finally said, oh, on first looking into Chapman's Homer, he's using the word not in terms of the Greek poet, but knocking one out of the park. And he's written this elaborate, he's interpreted the poem as Keats going out to see two ball teams play and a guy named Chapman who hits a home run. Well, it's ingenious. It's brilliant. It's wrong. Your first object in reading poetry is make sure you know what the words literally mean as they're down on the page. So even though the poet here is saying, I wrote on many levels, let's start, you know, if we're climbing on the elevator known as Dante, let's make sure we start on the ground floor. We're not going to get anywhere, okay? If you try to immediately enter the elevator when it's up on the 20th floor, you're going to fall down the shaft. It will do you no good. Make sure you get the literal level first, but be aware, and it's the reason the work can be returned to over and over again, because of the richness, because of all that's there to offer us. Now, there's certain things that the overall work gives us. Again, we need to know the structure of the overall work as we head in. Be aware, when you read Dante, of his obsession with threes, with the number three. It's easy enough for us, I think, as Catholics, to understand where this comes from. Dante, the poet, honors the Trinity all the way through this work. So that all the way through the design of the work, he's operating using threes. Most obvious and evidently, we have a three-part poem. The Divine Comedy is in three parts. It's not a single work. Three separate parts. Separate titles, separate names. He divides that afterlife into those three realms and writes about them in that way. We have the Inferno, the Purgatorio, the Paradiso. He then, after an introductory first canto, we have 100 cantos in the work. We have one introductory canto, which is why the Inferno is 34 cantos long. But after the first canto of introduction, we have 33 cantos in the Inferno, 33 cantos in the Purgatorio, 33 cantos in the Paradiso. 3-3-3s all the way through. He then comes to design the verse form that he's using. And it's called, the English word is the tercet, Italian terzina. He devises a little three-line stanza, so that the very verse gets grouped into units of three. And the rhyme is very, and the rhymes link together, A-B-A, B-C-B, C-D-C, D-E-D, and the, all of the stanzas start linking up together. And I'll stop there, but the point is all the way through you're going to find this threeness. It's everywhere. You'll find it everywhere. And of course you'll find it even right at the end when the final vision of God at the end of the Paradiso, the three interconnecting globes of light. So that right from the start he's aware and he's leading us there. The final vision of God is a Trinity and it's light and the light is interconnecting. It is interconnecting. Now, in order to read the work, here's something essential. You've got to draw a division, make a distinction. We have two Dantes in this work. We have Dante the poet. We have the man who is writing this poem. And the man is writing the poem looking backward. He is telling us something that happened to him. And he gives us the date. The Divine Comedy begins on Good Friday in the year 1300. It covers, of course, we could have guessed it, 3 days. It will end on Easter Sunday in the year 1300. He will make this journey down through hell, climb Mount Purgatory, and ascend through the Paradiso in the space of 3 days. We begin on Good Friday, we end on Easter Sunday. But he is right, he says, this is what happened to me, this is what I experienced, this is what I lived, let me tell you about it, which means the storyteller is telling us a story of something that happened to him in the past. Because we know he began writing it sometime after the year 1300, and he finished it just before his death in 1321. So that he is telling us events that took place in the past, and the principal character is named Dante. He is his own principal character, but he's looking back on himself. So we have Dante the poet, who is sitting writing the poem, and we have Dante the pilgrim, who took this journey in the past. Why is that important? The importance is Dante the poet knows things and is presenting Dante the pilgrim often critically. The man who begins the journey is not the man who some years later is writing the poem. The pilgrim who begins the journey has much to learn. And we get it almost instantly. Turn to the very opening canto. We're doing translation. It may not be the same as the one you have. Midway along the journey of our life, I woke to find myself in a dark wood, for I had wandered off from the straight path. Fascinating things going on there. But notice where we begin. It's very clear. I was halfway through my life. He assumes that it wasn't quite the halfway point. He died earlier than he thought he would. But he's assuming it's the midpoint. But notice the word in the first line, midway along the journey of our life, not my life, our life. This is the journey we all take. The vision is all of our lives are a journey. And we all make a similar journey. And then we go from our to I woke to find myself. I'm telling you something that applies to all of us, but I'll tell it from my personal perspective. I woke. He'd been sleeping, to find myself in a dark wood. Poetic image. Poetic image. But it goes back to an image. That poetic image is something that calls up almost a primal fear in all of us. Being lost in a dark wood is a frightening thing. It's the reason why fairy tales are just filled with children being lost in a dark wood. It is a primal fear. Dante's a grown-up, but he's a child spiritually and emotionally. And he suddenly finds himself in a dark wood, for I had wandered off from the straight path. There is a straight path that will take you through the wood. I'm back again to what I said earlier, free will and choice. I wandered off. I made the decision. I left the straight path. And look where I found myself. How hard it is to tell what it was like, this wood of wilderness, savage and stubborn. The thought of it brings back all my old fears. A bitter place. Death could scarce be bitterer. He's terrified. He wants to get out of there. And he's at a hill. He looks up and sees a mountain. He's going to try to climb up the mountain to get out the woods, but he cannot do it because he's blocked by three savage beasts that encounter him. A leopard, a lion, and a she-wolf. And those beasts won't let him pass. They've been interpreted a thousand ways. You can make up your own meaning. Or read what some intelligent commentators have had to say. They've had many comments on this. Fascinating notions. And he finds out he can't go that way. He's barred that way. He's lost in the woods. He doesn't know what to do. He's told he's going to be stuck there until the greyhound comes to save him. He doesn't know exactly who that will be, how he will get out. And then we realize the real beginning of the story, we thought we had begun it, does not begin here in the dark wood, but Virgil shows up. Virgil shows up and says, yeah, I'm here. Look, don't worry. I've come to guide you. Now, we then find out that the real action of the poem began earlier, and it began in heaven. And what happened was the Blessed Mother herself, Mary, has gone to Santa Lucia. Oh, of course, what light, the image of light, has gone to Santa Lucia and told her to go find Beatrice, because this guy needs help. Notice we get the three women. We've got the three beasts that he encounters, doesn't know where to turn, what to do, and we discover, wait a minute, already things are working in his favor. He hasn't been abandoned. The Blessed Mother's gone to Santa Lucia and said, go find Beatrice. She needs to help this guy. And we have the three protective female souls in heaven watching out for him. And Beatrice says, okay, and she goes to Virgil. At that moment, she goes to Virgil. I'm in the second canto. Virgil is explaining how he got there. I'm at line 70. This is wonderful. Beatrice goes down to the first circle of the inferno. She quite literally descends from paradise to the first circle of the inferno, goes to that comfortable land where all those classical poets are living, finds Virgil and says, I am Beatrice. She says, you've got to go help this guy. I am Beatrice who urges you to go. Notice, she doesn't order Virgil. We have a soul coming from heaven into the first circle of the inferno, but everything is still free will and choice. The Blessed Mother, through Santa Lucia, sent me down, and she said to you, you go get Dante the pilgrim. He's lost in the woods. There's none of that. Even in the afterlife, there is the vision of the souls having that freedom to make choices, and all Beatrice will do is say, I am Beatrice who urges you to go. I come from the place I am longing to return to. Love moved me, as it moves me now to speak. When I return to stand before my Lord, often I shall sing your praises to him. And then she spoke no more. These little moments are exquisite. This poem is just filled with those little moments. And the poet's not giving us commentary. He's letting us realize the scene imaginatively. It's beautifully done. One of the problems with the Divine Comedy is the verse is so simple and moves so quickly because of the interlocking tercets, we just whiz through it. We just whiz through it. One other thing, if you want to read it with a medieval mind, the medieval world had great patience. They loved long stories, and they would savor them slowly. And for the modern mind to go back, I'm going to use an old-fashioned technical. You have to go from 78 RPM down to 33 and a third. You've got to slow way down and allow the richness of what's being presented here, okay, to appear before you. It is absurd to eat a McDonald's hamburger at the same speed with which you eat lobster bisque. One indeed is just to be gotten down to fuel you for another couple hours. The other is something wonderful to be savored slowly, okay? Well, Dante is lobster bisque. Savor it slowly. It's glorious, and you can't get the richness of the taste unless you go that slowly. Now, why Virgil? What you're going to find, it's very interesting. I'll come to this later. Usually, and you can even read the commentators, they say Dante has two guides. Virgil takes him through the Inferno and the Purgatorio, and then Beatrice takes him through heaven. That's only partially accurate. There are, of course, and if you at this point, if you know anything about the poem, not two, but there have to be three. There is a third guide at the end of the Paradiso. I'll get to that later. Again in threes. And each one takes him on a certain part of the journey. Fascinating. Why Virgil? Why the classical world? Why this figure? Because Virgil, to the medieval mind, represented reason. He was a great poet, but he was the Roman poet. He was the reasonable poet. He did not even have, those Greeks had grand passions, but there are times they go out of control, which is absolutely true. Virgil is reasonable. And therefore, in order to get out of the dark wood, the first thing you need to do is exercise pure reason. And Virgil's the guide. Now, but he is not a philosopher. He's the reasonable poet, which implies, again, you need to use your intelligence, but in order often to move out of this place in which you find yourself, you need to awaken your heart as well. And what you have to do is begin with human feeling that is understood in order to move forward and get out of this place in which you find yourself. Hence, we get Virgil, a natural man, a reasonable man, a great poet. And it's absolutely true. You will know people who quite literally will find themselves in severe trouble, having lost their way, wandered off the straight path, and it may simply be some healthy music that will begin opening things up to them. It may be meeting one other person and a human connection is made, an emotional connection is made that will start the process. Start the process. It won't get us all the way there. We need other things to complete the journey, but that can be a beginning. And curiously, Beatrice at this point cannot come to the pilgrim Dante. He is not yet ready for that grace she represents. There is no way he can encounter this woman who has come from paradise. He's not ready. Grace is prior to nature, and grace perfects nature, but we have to start with nature. Being human, we have to start with nature and have to start with reason to get ourselves out of the fixes we get ourselves into. Hence, Virgil becomes the guide. He is guiding, but there are things that Dante the Pilgrim can understand that remain hidden for Virgil. Let's look at this quickly. I'm at the opening of Canto 3. You see how far we're getting. I've got 10 minutes left. We've made it the opening of Canto 3. We enter the vestibule to hell itself, and we see the inscription above the gate, and we hear the screams of anguish coming from below. It's a great scene. First thing we see, of course, is the inscription above the gate. We're heading into the Inferno. Here we go. I am the way into the doleful city. I am the way into eternal grief. I am the way to a forsaken race. Justice it was that moved my great creator. Divine omnipotence created me, and highest wisdom joined with primal love. Before me nothing but eternal things were made, and I shall last eternally. Abandon every hope, all you who enter. Fine inscription. We know, however, we're on our way to hell. Notice the first stanza of Canto 3. I. Even the inscription above the gate of hell is obsessed with the self. Here's who I am. Here's who I am. The gate of hell announces itself, puts the self forward. But then, not being all powerful, has to announce how it got there. It didn't create itself. It's asserting itself. Divine omnipotence created me. God the Creator. God the Father. And highest wisdom, the Son, and primal love, the Holy Spirit. The gate of hell has to announce the Trinity. Has to announce the Trinity. And then, of course, the famous inscription, abandon every hope, all you who enter. To go into hell is to abandon hope, because there's no getting out. There's nothing to look forward to. Glorious, glorious moment. Meanwhile, of course, we hear the shrieks for the first time. Let me say this about hell. I just have a few minutes left. In fact, let me try to wrap some of this up. We can get to specific cases this afternoon. Okay, we'll journey this afternoon. Come with your favorite circle of hell, and we'll go through it this afternoon. I don't mean to be too lighthearted, because it is serious stuff. Example being. One of the great aspects of this poetry, and one of the things we learn about hell, is that it is unbearably noisy. The noise is intolerable, and it is cacophony. It is not just the screaming, it is the clanging. The amount of noise that he forces in here is simply astonishing. Let me read, this is from a great translator of the poem, Dorothy Sayers, from her introduction. She's talking about the noise of hell, the sighs and wailing, the howls of Cerberus, yells of the hoarders and spendthrifts, the splashing and bubbling of the streams, the shrieks of the furies, the sibilant voices of the suicides sizzling like green wood on the fire, the thunder of the cataract, the sniffling and blowing of the flatterers, the quarrels and shouts of the malabranchi, the confused roar of the speaking flames, the teeth of the traitors chattering like storks, all the hideous, intolerable clamor of hell. It's a nice little passage, and she was a writer herself. She was a creative writer. It's a wonderful, you go into hell and the noise is intolerable. It's like going to see Independence Day. It's one of the reasons I walked out. The noise was intolerable. People sat there. I could barely eat my popcorn for the noise. And that was the only pleasurable part of the whole experience. The noise is intolerable. And if you want an example of how the modern world has become hellish, it's the noise out there. And the noise is there to prevent you from thinking. The noise is there to confuse you. All of the senses in hell are assaulted. I won't go into the descriptions of the stench. Hell stinks. It's awful. There are moments when they can't even descend because of the putrid fumes coming up from below. And Virgil and the pilgrim Dante have to stop just so the nose can adjust to the hideous smells as they descend lower. Poetry is sensuous. Poetry impacts the senses. Few have done it better than Dante. But what this does is confuse you. Dante is making this journey to learn, and as he descends, he is confused and tricked, and these souls are good. Let me, in the few moments remaining, just look at the most famous of all the encounters. It comes in Canto 5. The meeting with Francesca da Rimini. We're in the circle of the lustful, and all the lustful souls are flying about endlessly like birds. Okay? They have been animalistic, and hence, all the way through, we have that notion that the punishment fits the crime. It's called the contrapasso, the law of divine retribution. And as you sinned, so are you punished. so that having become animal-like and giving themselves over to animality, they're just flying around forever like birds. But notice, it's not even grand animalism. They are not grand imposing, they're little birds. Hence the old phrase, lecherous as sparrows. Birds just, they're insignificant. However, Francesca and Paolo stop to talk to Dante, and we get the inversion. Paolo never says a word. The man never says a word. The woman does all the talking. It's hell, all right. He, however, gasps and moans and sighs while she's talking. He gets to listen to her for all of eternity. And she just lays it on with a trowel. She insults Paola, talking about their great love, by trying to seduce the pilgrim. And he's there listening to her story. One day we read, to pass the time away, of Lancelot, of how he fell in love. She was a married woman. She's with her husband's brother. And of course, what they're reading about is the adulterous love of Lancelot and Guinevere. We were alone, innocent of suspicion. Time and again, our eyes were brought together by the book we read. Our faces flushed and paled. To the moment of one line alone, we yielded. It was when we read about those longed-for lips now being kissed by such a famous lover that this one, who shall never leave my side, you'll notice what a great love it is, that this one, who shall never leave my side, then kissed my mouth and trembled as he did. He liked me. Notice her focus is on what? I. It's that inscription above the gate. Our Galahad was that book, and he who wrote it. That day we read no further, she says. She's still polite. And all the while the one of the two spirits spoke these words, the other wept. In such a way that pity blurred my senses. I swooned as though to die and fell to hell's floor as a body dead falls. The translator has done a wonderful job there of giving you the rhythm of that. What's happened? She seduced him. He feels so sorry for them. And so have most readers since then. Oh, and they're sentimentalized. Nope. What we have is justice, God's justice. And what we have to do at that moment, and the pilgrim will come to learn this as he continues to descend, is look each of these sins in the face and understand it is our own. Dante comes upon this scene of seduction and is seduced by it. He falls guilty of the same sin. He is, now, not in the physical way, but sympathy for the poor things. All they did was commit a little adultery, and now look what happened to them. Poor things. And having made that mistake in judgment, what happens? I swooned as though to die and fell to hell's floor as a body dead falls. Boonk. He loses consciousness, reason, intellect. It all goes, and he becomes as one dead, and he himself falls. It's magnificent. It's magnificent. Virgil revives him. Virgil won't abandon him. He learns the lesson and on we go, but he keeps making these mistakes. The pilgrim is all of us. The pilgrim is man going through the world. The pilgrim sins all the way through hell and has much to learn as we, making our journey, encounter the sins and fall and find death, but have the hope of being revived. We'll go through some of the rest of it this afternoon, 3:00. 3:00. See you then.